You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. As part of our state continues to be under crisis standards of care, and Idaho's test positivity rate sits at 34%, could there be any good news on the horizon when it comes to this current surge? Joining us today to talk more are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, as well as Dr. Kenny Bramwell, System Medical Director for St. Luke's Children's Hospital. I want to thank both of you for being here today.
Thanks, Gemma.
Happy to be here, Gemma. Thanks.
And if you have questions for our medical experts, now is the time to email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Dr. Pate, can you give us an update on where we are in terms of Omicron? I know that we had another news briefing yesterday where, as I mentioned, a 34% positivity rate. That is high in terms of when you're dealing with a pandemic.
It is. And the transmission rate is also exceedingly high right now. The good news is that our Omicron, or at least our first Omicron surge, the BA1, has peaked and we are clearly on our way down. But as Dr. Turner mentioned in the news segment that precedes this, the transmission rates are still extremely high. The test positivity rate is extremely high. And so just because we are on the way down doesn't mean there's not still a lot of risk out there to get infected. But it is good news that we have peaked, we're on the way down. And at this point, we have to continue to get the transmission rate down. And then, of course, we're already watching for the next variant that has already been detected in the United States and is causing some problems in some European countries. So we're watching it to see if that's going to be our next surge. And if so, it could be that we would see that within the next month.
And Dr. Brumwell, can we talk a little bit about what you are seeing in terms of pediatric cases of Omicron at St. Luke's? My understanding is you are seeing more children at this point in the pandemic than has been seen at any other time.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Gemma. We look at our daily census, and I actually, in my role, look at every single patient who gets admitted with COVID because, at least historically, it had been one or two handfuls of kids each month. We had, in the month of January, we had 55 kids admitted to St. Luke's Children's with COVID. The highest we had ever had before was 31 back in September in our Delta peak. And the average month to month is probably about 10 children who need to be admitted. So we had, you know, five times our monthly average last month. We had an enormous number of children who needed to be admitted, and that's a little concerning, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Brumwell, some possible good news on the horizon, though. I believe it was just last week that Pfizer has been asking the FDA to approve the COVID vaccine for ages 6 months to 5 years old. How do you see this potentially playing out in Idaho once that approval is given? And I ask that because we don't have great vaccination rates for kids that can already be vaccinated.
Yeah, that's a great point, Gemma. You know, the good news is that for those families who are interested, because I don't expect a one-year-old to be able to express interest in this, but for those parents who are interested in vaccinating their toddlers and preschool-age children, it looks reasonably likely that that'll be able to happen in the next 4 to 8 weeks. You also mentioned, you know, our historical vaccination rates as a state are either 49th or 50th. Every once in a while we get to 48th, but we have a problem with routine immunizations as a state. And we have certainly had a problem with COVID vaccination as a state. There are people who are hesitant, who are Sometimes they're vaccinated themselves. Frequently, they aren't vaccinated themselves, and then their children don't get vaccinated. So the good news is that it is likely that we will be able to start vaccinating these youngest of children. The bad news is that uptake will likely not be particularly high locally.
And Dr. Payne, can we go back to something you mentioned about, you said there is another variant that scientists, that the medical community is watching. Is this a different variant than the Omicron subvariant that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's confusing because this is another sublineage of Omicron. So it's technically Omicron, but when people, because the World Health Organization has not yet designated, there's really about four different sublineages of Omicron that are being monitored. The one that we are going through right now here in Idaho and across the United States is BA1. But there's another sublineage called BA2 that has been causing some problems in Europe, also in India, Singapore, a few other places. And we know it is here in the United States, and it's on the increase here in the United States, but it's still at very low levels. But we will recall that's what happened with this current form of Omicron. It was in very low levels, but within a month's time, it completely took over Delta, essentially. And that's the fear with this one, is that it could increase very quickly as well. There are a few other things that we're watching as well. Why this is particularly of note is, it's early, it's new, and so we don't have a lot of information, but some of the European countries were reporting that even people that got this current form of Omicron and therefore had quote unquote natural immunity, they were seeing appeared to them to be a striking rate of reinfection with this second version of Omicron. We don't have any details on that or specifics, but that is certainly a concern that someone might be infected with this current surge and then in a month could get infected again. We don't know. We're going to have to watch, but that's what we're concerned about.
I'd like to talk a little bit about mask mandates, because we're seeing this across the United States. For example, the state of California is going to be rolling back its indoor mask mandate. However, counties and municipalities in that state have their own have jurisdiction. So LA County, for example, will be keeping their indoor mask mandate at least for now. The state of New York is going to be rolling back its indoor mask mandate. Here in Idaho, the city of Ketchum had a city council meeting Monday. They have decided to remove the mask mandate there as well. Dr. Bramwell, I want to start with you. Is it too soon to be doing this? Or, some people would argue that, look, we got to get back to some sense of normalcy. I like to say that this is our normal now. We've been like this for 2 years.
Yeah, that's a great question, Gemma. And I think lots of governors who have intervened in the past are starting to loosen those requirements. Governors that haven't intervened in the past are not intervening now. I would say that the coasts tend to be about 4 weeks ahead of us as far as their exposures and as far as their trajectory with COVID. So locally, we are still in the thick of this current wave. We certainly have data that support the idea that we're on the back end of the crest, but we're not out of it by any stretch. So certainly for me, locally, it's too soon, though nobody asked me at the level of the Ketchum team. We're still struggling. And I have some insight. I happen to know that schools are struggling. It's not just that the hospitals are full, because that's one problem. It's also that schools can't stay open because they run out of teachers and substitute teachers and bus drivers. We are having some challenges, admittedly, within St. Luke's, keeping all of our clinics and hospitals open because so many people are currently out with COVID, or maybe it's their spouse, or maybe it's their child. So in my mind, it's a bit premature to say, hey, don't wear masks in these indoor places.
And with that said, Dr. Pate, we then have the Idaho legislature that's considering a ban on mask mandates, which to me seems to go against this idea of freedom and private business being allowed to do what they would like to do.
Yeah, you know, it is ironic that the Republican Party, of which I'm a member, has in the past been kind of anti-regulations, and especially anti-regulations of businesses and all, but this legislature seems very willing to tell businesses what to do. You know, the issue is really a different one than what Dr. Bramwell just addressed. And let me just applaud his comments about masks right now. He's exactly right. The level of disease transmission is too high. Our hospitals, although not at the worst point they've been, are still struggling to some extent. This isn't the time to relax this. But the legislature issue is a whole different question, because, and what I've tried to help legislators understand is, let's put COVID aside for a moment. I get it that there are lots of people that think about COVID differently than Dr. Bramwell and I do, and might think that it's minor, it's not a problem, it's nothing to be concerned about. So let's just put that aside. What I've told some people is, look, what you have to do is plan for our next pandemic. And I have mentioned that I could name probably a dozen viruses with pandemic potential off the top of my head that would have mortality rates of 30 to 50 times what COVID is, and viruses that would not spare children the way that COVID has. And so my point being is, it is foolish for the legislature to make long-term decisions that handicap us and handicap our response to a future pandemic, because we will have one, just because of the backlash about this current one. And so, you know, if we have another a pandemic coming, and it is going to be one of these severe ones that I'm thinking of, we have to have some ways to protect people until we develop therapeutics and vaccines and so forth. And I do think the public's response will be different if, to quote a couple of the legislators, people are dying in the streets. And so why would we want to handicap ourselves for the future? I think that the legislature has been too focused on all the alleged wrongs and so forth right now. To my knowledge, I don't think they've had any meetings or hearings on what do we need to do to prepare for the future, and they need to be thinking about the future.
So we've had some questions in regards to the blood shortage, so we wanted to start this segment with a voicemail. Let's take a listen to this.
Thank you for your show, Gemma. It's been really nice to have Dr. Pate and your other experts every week. Just had a question about the blood shortage. Not sure if I missed this or if you already covered it, but if you live in a rural community like the Wood River Valley, how do you help by donating blood if there isn't a drive that you're aware of? Is there a way to donate blood? Thanks. Bye.
What do we know about that, Dr. Pate, Dr. Bramwell?
So, yes, there are ways to donate blood. If you're in those rural areas or remote areas, It is mostly going to be drives, and you can go to the American Red Cross website and you can put in your zip code, and then it will bring up a list of the drives, you know, that are in your area, and let you know if there are openings in those drives. So, you know, that's going to be the most convenient. Obviously, if the person living in the Wood River Valley has reason to be coming to Boise for something, you can also try to actually, you know, schedule a donation at the Red Cross, one of the Red Cross donation centers. But the most convenient thing is going to be one of the drives that are held out there.
And Dr. Bramwell, Sunny in Haley wrote in, and she says, a friend and I gave blood at a Red Cross drive in Haley in early November. My friend later received an email from the Red Cross that her blood had antibodies and it could potentially be used for certain people. She was unaware that she had had COVID. Do you have antibodies in your blood as a result of vaccination or only actual infection?
These are great questions, Gemma, and a lot of it, I would need to do a little bit more research about exactly which antibodies were being tested. I do know that the donated blood was routinely being tested for these antibodies through much of last year and the year before. My understanding is that they had recently stopped doing that testing. And the other thing that's probably relevant for this listener question is that they only did a random portion of the blood that was donated. So the fact that one person got a letter saying she had positive antibodies and one person did not get a letter doesn't necessarily mean that the second person didn't have antibodies. It could just be that her blood wasn't tested, so they didn't know. The challenge with trying to pin something very specific on these antibodies is a bit flawed, which is why we haven't yet used the antibodies for clinical decision or for clearance or for return to work, or any of those sort of things that may happen sometime in the future, but we're not there now. In essence, we don't know enough about antibody levels and titers and transmissibility and all of those things to be able to say this level means exactly this. We have used the antibodies for some of our patients who have been admitted to the hospital to confirm that they had a recent infection. This comes to play in our MISC patients, multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, where they commonly get profoundly ill 4 to 6 weeks after their illness from COVID. So when they get tested for COVID, they're negative, but we can see evidence of a recent infection. Hopefully that answers those questions.
It does. Dr. Pate, Sheila wrote in and she says a friend's doctor told her she could go without a mask for 90 days because she has immunity after getting over a current case of COVID. So Sheila asks, is that true or misinformation?
Well, like most things, there is some truth to it, but it's not completely accurate. So I think that what the doctor is referring to is at least up through Delta, not Omicron, but up through Delta, it has been the case that most people do seem to be fairly well protected from reinfection for a period of about 90 days or 3 months. So that's where that number came from. Here are the problems. Number one, we have no idea for a particular individual. In other words, we can only look at populations of people who have been infected and say, you know, on average, they're going to be protected probably for the next 3 months. But again, that was before Omicron. We have reason to believe you're protected for a much shorter period of time if it was Omicron you were infected with. But even within that population, we will find some people that have a very vigorous immune response and others that have a very paltry immune response. So trying to apply those population statistics to an individual can be flawed because we have no idea whether she's one of the better responders or weaker responders, and we can't know. The other issue is that when we are having new variants come up like we are, and we have very high levels of disease transmission, really everyone is well advised, whether infected or vaccinated. If you're going to be in public areas and around people that you don't know if they are fully vaccinated and boosted, it is always a wise thing when you have this much disease transmission level going on to be wearing a high quality mask regardless.
Dr. Bramwell, Denise wrote in and she says, I'm wondering how transmissible Omicron is outside. Specifically, is dining outside risky? And Dr. Bramwell, I asked this question because I think there's been different information on this. I mean, in the past with other variants, it's been okay to be outside without a mask on. I think a lot of people are wondering if that's the case with Omicron, like if you're in a crowd.
Right. That's a great question. I'll tell you what we have started doing in my family with my wife and my kids and our other close friends is we have come up with a scoring system. And we have, I will admit to you freely, we have just made this up. And we try and gauge things like how risky was it for my daughter to go to the BSU basketball game last Saturday versus how risky is it for us to have one of my high school daughter's friends over for dinner versus how risky is it to go out to eat when we can sit on the patio. So we have come up with scores ranging between 0 and 100, 0 being the first few months in the pandemic where we all, out of some fear, were hiding, and 100 where the risk is, you know, I'm going to say a rock concert with 10,000 people inside a building. So I would certainly put outdoor dining as lower risk than many activities. Lots of people are dining in and out. It's still a bit brisk to dine out for most of us. But I would say that certainly some activity like walking outside or going for a hike, I don't think people are at much risk there. The difference in an indoor setting is, at least in the restaurants I've seen, we no longer have spaced tables. In other words, there were some months during the early phase of the pandemic where some restaurants closed or they reopened very cautiously. Now it seems like we're business as usual here locally in Boise, where things are open and the tables aren't spread and there are lots of people. So there is, I would say, some degree of risk eating in a restaurant, probably a lower risk if you're able to eat outside once that opens up here or becomes feasible in another month or so. But I haven't seen any good data that quantify this very well.
I have to say, I really appreciate your risk assessment, though, Dr. Bramwell, about kind of making a scorecard, because I do feel that we're all in this space now, right? Where we, especially I think those of us who have been vaccinated, who have been doing all of the right things, you want to have some semblance of a life, right? And so it's this kind of, you know, assessing what risk you're willing to take.
Yeah, we do that quite a bit, and we're trying to ratchet back and assume more and more activity, but we talk about it pretty frankly, like I said.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. We just heard from Patty, and she has a couple of questions that, frankly, we've been getting from other listeners as well. So Patty and her husband, they are both senior citizens. They've both been vaccinated, boosted, and hypervigilant. However, Patty tested positive in January. She did quarantine away from her husband for 10 days, and she says she only has a slight recurring cough and congestion. So here are some of her questions. Patty says, my doctor and other sources say not to bother with a rapid post-test, so how can I be sure I'm no longer contagious to my husband or an immunocompromised friend. So Dr. Pate, can you start with that first question?
Yeah, so typically what we see is in those who have been vaccinated and especially boosted, if which I think is what she says she was, and get infected, they clear the virus much faster than somebody who's not vaccinated, meaning that somebody who's not vaccinated will be contagious for a longer period of time than somebody who is fully vaccinated. And in those that are fully vaccinated, we typically don't see high enough levels of infectious virus to infect other people after about the sixth day. So if she does a full period of isolation because she had the infection, 10 days, we believe that just statistically speaking, she's not likely to pose a threat. Now, with that said, again, if you're going to be around people who are immunocompromised, regardless of whether you've been infected, vaccinated, whatever, you should still wear high quality masks because immunocompromised people are just at great risk. But on the other hand, if she can do the rapid tests, there has been some conflicting data, but we've gotten a recent study that seems to suggest that the rapid test may be a reasonable proxy for whether she's infectious. So what I would say is that if she's isolated for 6 days, 7 days, it might not be unreasonable to go ahead and do the rapid test. If it's positive, one should certainly assume that they may still be contagious. If it's negative, it is some evidence that they may be less likely to expose others. But again, usually what I would use that as a guideline for getting out of the home, but I would still wear a mask.
And one more question that she had, Dr. Pate, when can she be confident that her husband did not contract COVID from her because she tested positive? I believe Patty said in January. So I would assume
so,
weeks ago.
Yeah. So if first of all, more good news about being vaccinated. If you are fully vaccinated, and especially if you're boosted and you get infected, the chances are much better than even that you won't infect somebody in your household. So it decreases those chances. So that's the good news in terms of there being a better than even odds that she did not infect her husband. What we would expect is that if she was going to infect her husband, that likely would have occurred within about 3 days, especially if we're talking about Omicron, within about 3 days of the time that she realized she was infected. And so what we often do is we tell these household members, wait 5 days, get a test, and you can test yourself. But if given the amount of time that it's been, and if he developed no symptoms and is fine, chances are she did not infect him. If she did infect him, given that he's vaccinated and boosted and he had very mild symptoms, then obviously there's nothing for us to worry about. And in fact, that infection has been shown in people that are vaccinated to give them even a higher level of future protection. So I would tell her that there's no reason for her to be concerned or to feel guilty about this. It sounds like they're both getting through this just fine. And they certainly can thank their COVID vaccines for doing so well.
Go ahead, Dr. Bramwell.
I would add that she should be congratulated. Anybody who can be happily married and not share COVID, they're doing an amazing amount of work and being exceptionally diligent. If one of them contracts COVID and the other does not, they should be very pleased that they pulled that off.
Well, Dr. Bramwell, I told my husband a long time ago that if he comes home with COVID, he's going upstairs to the extra bedroom and he's not leaving for 10 days. So end of story there.
We have invoked the mean rule a few times with our college age daughter who has had COVID twice and wanted to come home. So we've let her come home, but she has a bell and she stays in a room and we drop dinner off and we ring the bell and then we walk away. So it can be done. It's just not simple.
So Dr. Bramwell, you've basically set up room service for her. I mean, this is perfect.
Yeah. Why would you ever want to leave? Yeah.
Why would you ever want to leave? All right, let's get back to some more questions. Kit wrote in, and this is a question that we've gotten quite a bit as well. And she says, I've heard that getting Omicron helps build up your immunity against other strains of the coronavirus like Delta. She wants to know if this is true. Dr. Bramwell, can you take that?
Sure. I'll start off by saying that I don't think that getting any of these viruses is a great intentional option. I hear about the COVID parties and such, and I think that's just rolling the dice. But I will say that it seems that if you are exposed to a variant and another variant comes along, that the exposure that you've had, just like and maybe less than the vaccines that you've had, helps prepare you for the next one. Omicron may be disproving that having Omicron a month ago doesn't mean you're not going to get it next month, which is unfortunate. But there is certainly some truth to the concept that if you have a virus and then you're exposed to the same virus in the future or a close relative of that virus in the future, you're more prepared. Your immunity is prepped to participate a little more quickly. The natural immunity, I'm saying that in air quotes here, because I don't think that's ever been shown to be as good as the vaccine immunity. Let me just sidebar something here. You know, we talk about natural immunity like it's going to solve this sometimes in some circles. And I think we would be hard pressed to come up with an example in the last century where natural immunity beat down a disease. All of the victories that we've had in the public health sphere against different diseases like diphtheria and smallpox and polio, those have gone away through vaccination. There was never enough natural immunity to smallpox to make it go away. So while I think that natural immunity is certainly helpful, I don't think that it's sufficient on its own.
Good point there. Dr. Pate, Barbara wrote in, and she is asking, what are the indications for a fourth dose of the vaccine? Who are considered the, quote, moderately immunocompromised?
So currently, the only recommendation in the United States for a fourth dose is for those who are moderately or severely immunocompromised. To determine whether you fall in that category, you should probably have a discussion with your doctor about your particular condition. It can be an issue for some people that they have immunodeficiencies, and for other people, it can be that they have either a condition that weakens their immune system or they're on treatment for a condition that weakens their immune system. But that should be a conversation with the doctor to determine whether they should get that fourth vaccine, whether they qualify. The other consideration in somebody who probably tends more towards the severe immunodeficiency as part of the spectrum is we also have a treatment option called Evusheld, which is in limited supply, but we do have it here in Idaho. And this is a treatment that we can give these immunocompromised people that can protect them for as long as 6 months or more, because we actually give them the antibodies that are highly effective at blocking the coronavirus. So that would be the other consideration that your doctor should consider. Should you get a fourth shot? Should you get the Evusheld? Should you get both? But I would just talk to your physician about that.
And Dr. Bremwell, Sarah wants to know if you could please explain about why it's safer to be gathered with groups or family or friends that are vaccinated as opposed to people who are unvaccinated, if we can all spread it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think Dr. Pate touched on a few of these concepts already, but I think they bear repeating. You know, if you are vaccinated and boosted, you are as prepared as you can be for the inevitable Omicron exposure and probably illness. If you have done all those things and you get a significant exposure and suddenly you become sick, the data that we have seen so far support a few ideas. First of all, you are more likely to have a milder illness. Second of all, you are more likely to have a shorter illness. And third of all, you are less likely to spread it as long. So you have, if you think about graphing all of this, you have a shorter, squashed, and less severe curve to your illness than people who are unvaccinated. You know, we have Idaho-based data that got released in the last 10 days that show that if you're vaccinated, you are 11 times less likely to end up admitted to the hospital and 20 times less likely to die from COVID. So the back to this initial question is, you know, if you are around a group of 20 people and they're all vaccinated, your risk will be lower. It's not zero, but your risk is lower than being around a group of 20 people who are unvaccinated. You know, we have to assume that there's a certain number of people who are shedding the virus and are currently asymptomatic. So your odds are just better for you being around people who are vaccinated as opposed to those who are unvaccinated.
And Dr. Pate, since Idaho went back into crisis standards of care, we have been hearing from a significant number of listeners who are upset at the unvaccinated. For example, Barbara wrote in and she says, it's unconscionable to me that people willingly vaccinated to protect fellow human beings are being sidelined from emergency care and sometimes dying because those who are unwilling to be vaccinated and are overrunning our hospitals. David in Boise went on to say that he thinks the unvaccinated should be triaged out of treatment. And Dr. Pate, I think there is a lot of frustration out there from people who have taken this virus seriously, who have been vaccinated, who have worn masks, who have done all of these things. And 2 years into this, you're exhausted. With that said, you can't not give treatment to someone because they've made poor decisions.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people that have the same sentiment that David expressed. And certainly many people that have done all the right things, and I think particularly those who have done all the right things and have had to significantly restrict their lives because they have a small child in the home, because they live with an elderly person who is at high risk, or because someone in their family is immunocompromised, you know, I think those folks are particularly bitter because these other people are literally putting their lives in jeopardy. You know, we saw lately the callous disregard of Wayne Hoffman of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, who indicated that he had tested positive and then bragged on social media that he was going to the grocery store. Well,
without wearing a mask, by the way.
Right, without wearing a mask. And you know, there's going to be elderly people in that grocery store. There are going to likely be some people that do have risk factors, and this is irresponsible, and it's aggravating. I think that the problem with what the listeners are expressing is the point that you made, Gemma, and that is, if it's a slippery slope, if we say to Dr. Bramwell and to other hospital leaders, hey, if somebody contributed to their own illness or injury, you know, don't treat them, you have no idea. That is probably might clear out half of the hospital, because it's not just those people that didn't get vaccinated, but there are people who have drank alcohol before they got behind the wheel of a car and might be in an accident. There are people who have done other risky things. You know, if you go base jumping in Twin Falls and hurt yourself, do we treat that person or do we not? And it just gets to be a really slippery slope. The ethics of our profession has been, you know, we take care of everybody, and everybody deserves care. And I guess what I would tell to those who are frustrated, because I feel it, I have to have a talk with myself fairly frequently about mm-hmm. these folks. But when I talk to them, the problem is many of them have been misled. They've been lied to, they've been misled. And I think that rather than getting mad at the people that haven't been vaccinated, we need to get mad at those legislators and those doctors that are spreading misinformation and disinformation that are scaring people from getting vaccinated.
And do remember that we do have laws on the books when it comes to knowingly infecting someone, for example, with the HIV virus. You know, it's Idaho Statute 39-608. And if you knowingly infect someone, that's a crime. So at some point, you know, states are probably going to be looking at that if you knowingly infect someone. These are things that we have seen in the past with HIV. I would throw that out there. I mean, we only have about a minute left, Dr. Pate, but you know, it's different when you're knowingly doing something versus
right.
You may have COVID and you may not know.
Right. I mean, certainly what Wayne Hoffman did is that's worthy, that's conduct worthy of preventing that by law. And he should share some accountability for making a willful, careless, disrespectful decision. The other thing that I think is coming is that I think more and more insurance companies and more employers are going to start shifting costs to those that are not vaccinated because they're incurring a lot of the costs. So just like a smoker might pay higher insurance rates, I suspect it's coming that those people that aren't vaccinated will pay higher rates.
I want to thank both Dr. Pate and Dr. Bramwell for their time today. And of course, for your advice and your wisdom and your science. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.